WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Hal Hartley, is an independent film director and screenwriter. His movies include Trust, The Unbelievable Truth, Amateur, and Henry Fool. He's described his ongoing theme as societies, families, and groups of individuals and their relationship to what they consider the worst in them. His new movie is his version of a monster movie. It's called No Such Thing, as in the expression, there's no such thing as monsters. The monster is a very human-looking entity that lives in Iceland. The other main character is a young woman, played by Sarah Polley, who works in New York at a tabloid TV news magazine. Her boyfriend was with a crew from the show that went searching for the monster and is believed to have been killed by the monster. She soon sets off for Iceland to find out what happened. From the opening of the film, here's the monster speaking.
I'm not the monster I used to be. I admit that. I'm tired. I'm weaker. I'm losing my memory. And I can't sleep. Still, these friends of yours, well, they're dead now. I tore all three of them to pieces and tossed the whole mess off the cliffs out back. Let the vultures fight over what's left. This is ridiculous. I try to withdraw. I retire. I hide. But still you find me out. Even my dreams. Polluting my solitude. Filling the air itself with your unending and pointless noise. Go ahead, kill me! Try it!
I asked Hal Hartley about creating a contemporary monster.
Of course, monsters, you always have to find out first, what is their Achilles heel? What can kill them? And I started to work from there. And then I thought, information, this is what everybody calls the information age. And I thought, all right, so maybe I'll dream up a monster from that perspective. First find out what his Achilles heel is and then work backwards to shape him. Later in the film, it's even brought up that perhaps the monster doesn't even exist, that humanity brought him into existence by sheer will of imagination. But his Achilles heel is that he doesn't know why he exists, and he can't die. But he can endure untold amounts of pain.
The monster doesn't exactly look like a monster per se. He looks like a human, but a human who hasn't kind of bathed or shaved in a very long time and is wearing a kind of like filthy blanket type of thing and has horns, but still he looks pretty human. His opposite in this is a very, beautiful, very kind of seemingly innocent and maybe naive young woman played by Sarah Polley. Do you see a connection between your story and Beauty and the Beast?
Not directly. I looked at every monster movie, when I began and said, what could I use? And the first one I looked at was Beauty and the Beast. I thought, well, given what I'm thinking about, perhaps this is the best place to start. But I found very little that I wanted to bring from that. I actually found more material to kind of converse with in the Japanese monster movies like Godzilla and Mothra. The fact that, yes, there is a beautiful young girl and this monster, and they kind of, they are attracted to each other for different reasons, but it's not a romance, I think.
Your movie, No Such Thing, is set in part in Iceland and part in New York. In the opening New York chapter, the young woman played by Sarah Polley wants to get out of New York and find this alleged monster in Iceland. But she is in a plane crash on the way. She's the only survivor. She's found in the ocean, and she manages to survive, but she has great damage done to her body. And in order to restore her body, she has to have this very painful operation. And it sounds like an operation that you invented. I've never heard of such an operation. Is this something that you dreamed up for the movie?
Absolutely.
Why don't you describe it? It's quite awful.
The idea was that eventually this young woman would meet the monster. I knew that. And I wanted the monster to be impressed with her in a way that he's not impressed with other members of the human race. That in some way he recognizes that she's unusually strong on a number of different planes, certainly emotionally, intellectually, spiritually, she's strong. But I wanted her also to have physically gone through something very intense. So basically, she's the only survivor of this plane crash, and they drag her out of the ocean, the North Sea, and she's, obviously a frostbite, and like every bone in her body's been banged up, and her spine is in pieces. And so the idea was that they put the girl in this rig, and they are going to put her spine back together again, but there comes a point when they can never let her sleep during this. They can anesthetize her in stages, but the anesthesia has to be diminished in stages so that as they get to the end of the very long operation, when the critical work is being done, she has no anesthesia at all. And this is when they're actually sticking needles and stuff in her spine, in her spinal cord. So it's about as painful as anything you could imagine, and you have to endure it.
What did you dream up such a horror?
Well, I was actually trying to imagine just the most painful thing that a person could go through. Two things informed it. One, when I was a kid, I had a friend who had a spinal tap, and I didn't know what that was. He didn't know what it was. And it took him like 3 or 4 years, little by little, to describe it to me and my other friends, It was like he didn't, at 14, he didn't have the language to discuss with his best friends the nature of the pain that he had endured. It was almost like he was embarrassed. It was odd. We were 18, 19 before he finally could talk about it. I had gotten attacked by a dog when I was about 24, I guess. One of these killer dogs that people like to have these days. Attacked me, bit me right in the face, and had torn up my my mouth above and below, and I had to have plastic surgery immediately without anesthesia because they needed me to be awake to work with them to stitch inside and outside my mouth and down my chin and up the side of my face. And so that was like a 6-hour ordeal. And the Novocaine, whatever they could do, the local anesthesia, would just pour right out because there was no, the body wouldn't hold it. It would just wind up
in my mouth. Horrible.
Yeah. And, I endured that. I never would have given myself a lot of credit for being, very stoic with pain, but people surprise themselves. They really do. So anyway, that was the idea, and those were the things I reached for.
So you took the inspiration from real life and then made up something based on it, but totally different from it.
Yeah, it needed to be larger and mysterious. And the difficult thing about writing that scene was sort of like saying enough to affect the audience, so that they can, in a sense, feel the pain, but not saying so much that you give it away. You have to sound authoritative, but basically be, blowing smoke rings.
And you're also not showing her being tortured. I mean, it's not a sadistic scene. You don't see very much.
Yeah, no, it's very, it's a kind of ceremony, that scene. Its pace, its steadiness. And we were thinking very much, Sarah and I, and the various designers, about The Bride of Frankenstein, that we felt like this was the scene where Sarah becomes the bride of the monster somehow, even before meeting him, you know, that they have to become equals on some level.
Because of what they've endured.
Yeah, pretty much pain is at the heart of it. I mean, he's enduring all of this pain. The more information there is in the world, the more radio waves, I guess, and things like that. Like one of the other doctors in later in the film says that he's sort of like a radar dish, and all this information, human-generated information, kind of gets directed at him. He picks it all up like he's an antenna, and it manifests itself in him as this incredibly intense pain. Which is why, I guess, he's in such a bad mood and he drinks a lot and he curses
right.
a lot.
A real crabby monster.
Yeah.
Did you watch monster movies as a kid?
Not many. No, I was scared of monster movies. I didn't.
That's the reason why you watch them, though, because they're scary.
Yeah, well, not me. I think I was a much more sensible kid. I stayed away from what scared me. But I began getting very interested in them when I got older. And in fact, one of the first movies that I became very interested in and watched again and again and again was Nosferatu by Murnau, the original silent, you know, vampire movie. And we thought a lot about that film and Werner Herzog's remake of it from 1978. We thought a lot about it for a couple of reasons. One, that we wanted a monster who was sort of like not mechanical and not... Basically, we wanted a monster where the actor could just act. You know, they wouldn't be too burdened down with special effects and stuff. And so we said, yeah, all right, so he'll be a man. You know, like, look at Nosferatu. It's really just a hand treatment and a face and head treatment.
My guest is independent director and screenwriter Hal Hartley. His new film is called No Such Thing. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Hal Hartley. He wrote and directed the new film No Such Thing. His first film, The Unbelievable Truth, was about two misfits. Josh, a convict getting out of prison who hitchhikes to Lindenhurst, Long Island, and ends up working for a garage. And Audrey, the garage owner's daughter, who's not cut out for a conventional life and is attracted to the convict. In this scene, she brings a book to the garage for him.
Life of George Washington, father of our country.
Thanks. What's this one?
Misanthrope, Moliere, it's a play.
What's a misanthrope?
Somebody who doesn't like people. I star in it. I mean, in class, we read it in class.
Are you the misanthrope?
No, I wanted to be, but they wouldn't let me play a man, so instead I play a flirt.
Is it an interesting role?
Being a flirt?
Mm-hmm.
Well, sometimes, but the thing about flirting is that it leads to harder things.
Is that bad?
No, it isn't bad. It's just that it turns out pretty badly for the woman I play.
What happens?
She can't stop flirting.
Ever?
It's just the way some people are. She flirts herself to death.
Yeah. It's a sad play.
Well, she doesn't die, actually. It's just that the only man who really loves her has impossible standards.
Mm. That's too bad.
Yeah, it is.
Well, does it have a happy ending?
Nobody gets what they want, and they all go away frustrated and sad.
Tragedy.
The Unbelievable Truth was set in Lindenhurst, Long Island, where Hal Hartley grew up. I asked why he set his first film there.
Like everything else, it's practical and aesthetic. It was a very, very small budget film, and I had to shoot it very quickly, and I needed, you know, whatever support I could get. And luckily, my extended family, my cousins and my aunts and uncles were able to help me, you know, give me places for the crew to sleep, let me shoot in their houses, etc. And then aesthetically, it's just... I grew up there and, you know, my imagination formulated stories and images there. It was very easy for me to write a scene of a certain type and place it on this street corner or in this backyard or at that beach. I guess, you know, that making my first film was this very quick opportunity that came up. You know, I was pretty much just standing there, you know, prepared to make another short 16-millimeter film, and then this opportunity came up. You know, someone was going to put money up for me to, you know, to make that same film in 35-millimeter as a feature, and, you know, I had to think on my feet. I just said, okay, well, how it's home, these places that I know, this subject matter, which is pretty much my, basic preoccupation all the time now at the age of 28. Let's just do it. I think I just told people what the story was out loud before I had even written the script. Mm-hmm. Kind of sort of used talking, telling people what the story was to convince them that it was a legitimate situation. And that was sort of like how I came up with the story. It probably changed a little bit every single time I told it to a different person. And by the time I said it three or four times, I was like, okay, now I have something to write.
Dialogue is a very important part of your movies. And it's very colloquial, the dialogue you write. And yet it's not quite naturalistic, because a lot of your stories aren't quite naturalistic. They're often...
That is really an excellent way of saying that. It's colloquial and not, you know, not naturalistic. That's, you know, I'm going to use that.
Oh.
If somebody asks me what I try to do, I'm going to say, that's exactly it. Again, it's sort of a method that you don't dwell on that much as a writer. You don't, like, get up in the morning and say, okay, I'm going to write colloquial dialogue that's non-naturalistic. But in fact, that's a very good way of saying it.
Well, can you talk about why you write in that way, and what your process of writing dialogue is?
Sure.
And when I say it's not quite naturalistic, I mean that's because your stories aren't quite naturalistic. I mean, they're kind of about real people, but real people who are extreme in one trait or another. The stories are often, in their own way, almost like parables, even though they're set, you know, in the contemporary world.
Mm-hmm. Well, the colloquial part is certainly that I just love the music of language, and I like hearing different people talk, talk in different ways, their accents, their, you know, and I love the misunderstanding of language, sort of how it works. Earlier in my career, anyway, I wrote a lot of scenes where people would be talking about two entirely different things to each other, but somehow they're communicating to each other, but they're actually saying all this other stuff, or, you know, or they're talking at cross purposes and just misunderstanding that they're understanding each other. I sort of like that kind of Rubik's Cube construction of language.
Your first film was in 1988. You've made independent films through your career. Are you ever frustrated that you're still making independent movies? Some people who started with independent movies have ended up, you know, making big budget studio films.
In the sense that there's not as many people to talk to. I just do what I have to do. I, you know, work in a very particular way, and the way I work has been very successful for me. But it does make it harder when there's fewer people working the way, for instance, I work generally. It's harder to get the films made. Because, you know, you begin to be seen as an iconoclast when you have no intention to be that. 10 years ago, making films like Henry Fool or Simple Man or Trust or something was just, these are like these smaller films made by individuals. And that's exciting and interesting and a great alternative to movies that are made by corporations, which are designed to meet, the expectations of the widest possible demographic. Now you're seen as some, you know, kind of oddity. And we didn't feel odd 10 years ago.
One last thing. I recently saw a movie, a documentary, about Iranian directors. and the kind of censorship that they're up against in Iran. And one of the young women directors interviewed in the movie, when asked who her favorite filmmakers were, one of them was Hal Hartley. And I thought, gee, are his films getting into Iran?
Yeah, no, they are. And I'm very happy about that. I mean, this is a very, as I'm sure you probably have heard, I mean, there's a real great cultural, well, I guess it would be called countercultural movement there in Iran. You know, very interesting people, interesting filmmakers, great actors, poets, everything. Yeah, and they're up against a pretty strict censorship there. But they do make their films. And people like McMalbuff manage to make films that challenge the government's position on things pretty dead on. But his success as an artist and a commentator in his country, unbelievably enough, is respected. I mean, I think it could be pretty tense for him. But anyway, I correspond with people in Iran and in that part of the world.
Hal Hartley wrote and directed the new film No Such Thing. It opens in 6 cities this weekend: Los Angeles, New York, Washington, D.C., Boston, Chicago, and San Francisco. This is Fresh Air.